KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It empowers the department to act in a way that is arbitrary and to choose who they're going to enforce again and who they're not going to.
The Trump administration has threatened to cut federal funding for K-12 schools that won't eliminate DEI programs.
For Tuesday, April 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. April marks National Poetry Month, and we are marking the end of the term for U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limón.
I'm writing toward bravery. I'm writing toward courage. And I think that there's a lot of us that are doing that right now.
Later, we speak with the author of a self-help book that went viral.
It jumped to the top of the charts when it was spotted in the hands of a Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver.
Give the best of what you have every day, and realizing that some days you're not going to have much to give. We're going to give 100% of whatever you have, and some days it's only going to be 20-30%.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump celebrated what he is calling 100 Days of Greatness with a rally in Michigan. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, it was a victory lap despite results that are decidedly mixed.
President Trump boasted his movement is taking back the country from a, quote, sick political class.
In 100 days, we have delivered the most profound change in Washington in nearly 100 years. I read a editorial today that this is the most consequential presidency in history. How about that?
Even critics agree Trump's presidency has been consequential by, among other things, pushing the limits of presidential power and launching a trade war that has sent consumer confidence spiraling. Trump also questioned the validity of polls that show him with the lowest approval rating at the 100-day mark of any president going back 80 years. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Trump administration's trade fight with China, including the imposition of 145% tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the U.S., is hurting companies there, but U.S. small businesses are also being affected. Many small U.S. firms that rely on Chinese-made goods for their survival are seeing dwindling stockpiles and much higher prices for imported goods. While the administration has backed off somewhat on some tariff items, including some auto parts, there appears to be little progress in reaching an agreement with China. China has imposed triple-digit tariffs of its own on U.S. goods. The Trump administration is looking to use military bases to detain migrants who officials say are in the U.S. illegally. KQED's Taichi Hendricks reports internal documents show an Air Force base near San Francisco could be one of them.
Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield, California, is one of several military sites around the country being considered. Early April emails show coordination among Department of Defense and Homeland Security officials to expedite the plans. Democratic Congressman John Garamendi, whose district includes the base, says he is seriously opposed.
An immigration facility would significantly hamper the national security work that Travis is responsible for.
Immigration officials did not confirm the base is under consideration, but say they are actively looking to expand detention capacity in California. For NPR News, I'm Taiki Hendricks in San Francisco.
General Motors is out with its first quarter earnings. The company says while earnings fell for the 3 months ending in March, revenues rose 2.3% on a double-digit increase in sales, where the automaker said for now it's shelving earlier guidance for full-year financials, saying the Trump administration tariffs have clouded the financial picture. Some better-than-expected earnings, though, including GM, sent stocks higher today. The Dow up 300 points. The Nasdaq rose 95 points today. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Atlanta-based UPS is cutting about 20,000 jobs and says it will close more than 70 facilities this year. As member station WABE's Marlon Hyde reports, as part of the company's plan to manage costs amid economic uncertainty.
UPS plans to reduce its workforce as it continues to cut the number of Amazon shipments handled in half by June of next year. Here's CEO Carol Tomei.
The environment may be uncertain, but with our actions, we will emerge as an even stronger, more nimble UPS.
Tomei says business owners are weighing their shipping options as tariffs persist. Last year, U.S.-China trade lanes made up 11% of the company's international revenue. In a statement, the Teamsters Union threatened to retaliate if UPS violates their contract by eliminating Teamster jobs and say the company is obligated to create 30,000 union jobs. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
Some former employees of ChatGPT maker OpenAI are urging top law enforcement officials in California and Delaware not to allow the company to transfer control of the artificial intelligence technology from a nonprofit charity to a for-profit business. In a letter to state attorneys general, 10 former employees of the company, along with a coalition of experts, including three Nobel Prize winners, say they're concerned about threats to humanity posed by AI. The company has said it wants to build AI that outperforms humans. Crude oil futures prices continue their downward slide today amid concerns about a boost in output from the cartel OPEC and worries about how Trump tariffs will affect global markets. Oil fell $1.63 a barrel to settle at $60.42 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. We start today with the latest on the Trump administration's threats to cut federal funding to K-12 schools. That is, if those schools don't agree to eliminate all DEI programs. Late last week, three federal judges in three separate cases made clear that the administration has work to do to convince the courts these anti-DEI efforts are legal. For more, we're joined by NPR's Corey Turner. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Corey, what exactly is the Trump administration telling schools they've got to stop doing?
Yeah, so in mid-February, the Education Department warned colleges and K-12 schools that they need to stop all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and teaching that it considers discriminatory. It's essentially trying to use federal civil rights law and the Supreme Court's 2023 affirmative action ruling to say that schools are talking about race too much and in ways that discriminates against some students. For example, the department says schools have, quote, toxically indoctrinated students with the false premise that the U.S. is built upon systemic and structural racism. The administration even created a website, Juana, for parents to report, quote, indoctrination in schools. And then finally this month, the department told districts they now have to certify in writing that they're not doing any of this or risk losing their federal funding. A bunch of lawsuits have now been filed, including by the nation's two big teachers unions and the NAACP.
And I understand, Corey, that we now have the first round of rulings in those cases. So tell us, what did these federal judges have to say?
Yeah, that's right. The judges, who are based in Maryland, New Hampshire, and Washington, D.C., agreed late last week to block, to a certain extent, the administration's funding threats for now. One of the judges is an Obama appointee. The other two are Trump appointees. And one critique they made is that the administration is telling schools to stop all DEI programs and teaching without clearly defining what DEI is, and that this vagueness is leading schools and teachers to self-censor out of fear. I talked to Blake Height. He's an associate at the Brumman Group law firm. They advise school districts on federal compliance. And he told me there's a real danger to this kind of vagueness.
It empowers the department to act in a way that is arbitrary and to choose who they're going to enforce again and who they're not going to.
And one of the New Hampshire ruling specifically warns that this use of vague laws to silence people is a hallmark of totalitarian regimes.
Corey, I want to ask, is it legal for the Trump administration or for any federal administration to tell states and to school districts what they can teach?
Technically, no. There are two separate federal laws on the books right now, have been for years, that clearly prohibit the department from exercising any control over curriculum or instruction. Now, the Trump administration is arguing that schools are discriminating against students in the classroom and it must therefore enforce federal civil rights law. In their opinions, though, two of these three judges make pretty clear they don't seem to buy that argument. And here I should say the Education Department did not respond to an NPR request for comment. Legal questions aside, though, Juana, you know, this is super interesting because Trump has said repeatedly he wants to close the department and leave education to the states. But this anti-DEI move is using federal power to push states to make changes in local classrooms. It's still early, obviously, and many of the legal folks I spoke to say it is likely the Supreme Court's going to have to weigh in here.
NPR's Corey Turner, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration says it will cut more than 70,000 jobs, 70,000, also hundreds of contracts from the Department of Veterans Affairs. And this comes after Congress authorized close to $1 billion in research funding for the agency. The pacemaker, how we do liver transplants, CT scans, all of these innovations came from the VA. And as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports, scientists fear that life-saving research will be scrapped.
Stephen Finn started working at the VA in 1982.
I was a primary care physician at the VA for 36 years up until the time I retired.
He saw patients but also held various leadership posts, including acting chief of research and development. And in four decades, he got to see that research work.
Yeah, I mean, a big one was the management of prostate enlargement. You know, when I went into practice, the standard treatment for men with prostate symptoms was surgery.
But then VA research revealed that medication, alpha blockers, was just as effective as surgery.
And so instead of sending a patient to a urologist for a surgeon, I could prescribe a pill.
Dr. Finn can go on. He watched veterans and civilians alike start to get nicotine patches to quit smoking, new PTSD treatments, both through medications and other therapy. And just as importantly, VA research uncovered things that don't work. Former chief of VA R&D Timothy O'Leary says the private sector has no interest in funding studies that might show that their new drug is not better than the old one.
Sometimes, and VA clinical trials have shown this many times, that new intervention really isn't any better. Well, pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies may not want to take the risk of that kind of outcome. But VA can take the risk because it's not in the business of selling drugs. It's in the business of doing the best possible job for veterans and the best possible job for taxpayers.
VA spokesman Pete Kasperowitz said VA is not planning to scale back its research mission, but is conducting a comprehensive review. And after initially calling a hiring freeze, VA paused that for research jobs, at least until June. Researchers say they worry that the public doesn't know how much U.S. medical innovation involves VA projects. Rashi Romanoff is with the National Association for Veterans Research. She's hoping the word will get out before the pause ends in about a month.
Investing in VA's biomedical and innovation arm is good also for America on the global stage. I think the pause has given us all a chance to be able to talk about that we should be doubling down in research investments.
But several researchers who NPR granted anonymity because they fear retaliation said the uncertainty means they're already losing critical support staff, like data analysts, to the VA's deferred resignation offers. And they're concerned that research projects that examine women's health or race-related health issues are likely to be cut, and that long-term projects could get interrupted, like the VA's Million Veteran Program, one of the world's largest genetic study groups. But the VA has promised massive job cuts, then pledged that none of those cuts will come from the VA's hundreds of thousands of frontline health jobs. VA has made no such pledge for medical research jobs. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
There's an event that happens in Portland, Oregon a few times a year. People of all backgrounds come together to sing for a few hours. It is a simple yet powerful idea, so powerful that the woman who runs it has been nominated for a Grammy twice. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
Cody Raven Morris went to graduate school to study music. During that time, she ended up talking a lot about equity. One day, she found herself in a workshop on the subject.
It kind of seemed like 45 minutes of making people feel guilty. And this room was made up of predominantly white people who showed up intentionally to learn. And I think that guilt just paralyzes them from conversations.
She was studying choral conducting and music theory, but she felt like there had to be a better way to get at the idea of equity.
This is exhausting and boring, and it's divorced from the people that it's talking about.
As a Black woman, she did think it was important. She felt like the best way to foster equity was just to bring people with different backgrounds together to talk to each other, or in her case, sing.
And incorporate it into a conversation at the forefront of building rapport and community, not as a topic that comes up when the world is on fire.
This is the philosophy now at the heart of her pedagogy.
Two parts and...
The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return.
Morris is now a professor at Portland State University. She leads a choir and teaches conducting, as well as leads community gatherings of singing. She's inspired so many people with her work that she's been twice nominated for a Grammy in the category of music educator. On a recent day, several dozen students have come to practice.
I like that the most. I like that the most. Four parts.
The choir is preparing for something called a community sing. Several hundred people usually show up. Some are in choirs that have been singing together for a long time. Some have no experience. It's in a church in downtown Portland. On the night of the event, one of the people there is Apollo Fernway. He's been working with Morris for several years. Fernway says Morris's teaching philosophy changed his life.
I actually have a degree in German, and then I heard Professor Morris talk like 4 years ago and said, I'm going to go back to school to be a choir teacher because that person is awesome and I want to learn from them. And now I'm here.
Literally, you heard her talk and you changed your entire trajectory of life.
Yep.
Fernway is here on this night conducting the Blueprint Ensemble Youth Arts Choir. It's a group of children. When Fernway takes the stage, he brings in the audience.
This means I sing. This means
you sing.
Do it.
In a matter of minutes, Fernway has hundreds of people, plus the youth choir, singing a song in two parts. One of the later songs is called We Are One. Several dozen people from different choruses sing it together. The people on the stage include all kinds. One 13-year-old girl from Eritrea is here with her mom. There are college kids with blue hair. One older woman with a walker has an oxygen tank. She's one of the most enthusiastic singers. When we laugh, when we sing, when we cry, say the lyrics. We are one. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When Ada Limón became the U.S. Poet Laureate back in 2022, she took that moment to reflect on poetry's power to connect, or to reconnect, people to the world around them, to love and to grief and healing. Her signature project has placed poetry in national parks around the country. The idea was to praise both what she calls our sacred and natural wonders and also to speak to, quote, the complex truths of this urgent time. Well, Limón's tenure has drawn to a close, so we have invited her back to talk about what this time has meant to her and to share some poetry. Ada Limón, welcome back to All Things Considered. Happy last couple of days of National Poetry Month.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you crisscrossed the country as poet laureate. I don't usually think of poet as a road warrior job where you have to get up and get on planes. But tell me what you've seen, what people have told you about how poetry fits into their lives right now.
Yeah, one of the misconceptions I had when I first took on the role was this idea that I was supposed to somehow bring poetry to the people, when in reality it was much more common for me to sit and receive the stories of people having an intimate connection with poetry already, or having poetry readings in libraries or in schools, and people really fostering the connection with poetry on a very human, intimate level.
This is poems they had written they wanted to share with you?
Yeah, sometimes there were poems that they had written, and sometimes there were poems that they had memorized and loved and put, you know, on the walls of hospitals. There's one place I went where there were poetry installations on the back of bathroom, the walls of bathroom stalls.
Does the poetry have to be good? I mean, you're a beautiful poet. You're a professional poet. You're a poet laureate. I'm sure some of the scraps of paper that people are showing you that they carry around are not quite at that level. Does it have to be good to have that kind of power?
You know, I think that poetry has the ability to heal the writer and to change the writer. And there's a lot of power in that. And so I might read something that I might not remember, right? That I feel like, oh, yes,
you
I glanced at
remember.
It. Yeah, right. And it's gone. But at the same time, to that person, they've transformed an experience into a piece of art.
So I mentioned your signature project. It is called You Are Here. Part of this was actually doing something very small and specific. Like, you actually put poems on picnic tables. Tell me what it looked like.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for bringing it up. I worked with the Poetry Society of America to choose poems that would fit for each of the seven parks that we had the beautiful opportunity to work with. And those poems are on those picnic tables. So you sit at the picnic table, you read the poem, and then you're in this really wondrous, beautiful area. And then each of the tables also includes a prompt that just says, what would you write to the landscape around you? So that it's not just the experience of reading the poem and gathering around the poem and gathering in a beautiful area, but also thinking about how you might write something back to the world. And I wanted to do that so that we could remember that the relationship with our landscapes is reciprocal.
So you did this at parks, at picnic tables all over the country, I mentioned, from Cape Cod to the Everglades in Florida to the Redwood Parks in California.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would read one of those poems for me. I know that you left one called Never Alone on a picnic table in the Redwoods.
Yes, by a beautiful poet named Francisco X. Alarcón, who wrote in English, in Spanish, and Nahuatl. And this poem really meant the world to me, and I thought how beautiful to be able to put his words in the Redwoods National and State Parks. Never alone, always this caressing wind, this earth whispering to our feet, this boundless desire of being, grass, tree, corazón.
Beautiful. Why that poem for that place?
Have you been to the Redwoods?
No, never. Now I want to go.
Okay, let's meet there.
I want to find your table.
Let's meet there. There's something about being in those trees that makes you feel so small, but small in that pleasurable, good way of knowing that there is something bigger than you. It really feels like, oh, I am part of something. And I wanted this poem to be there so that anyone who was in that space could recognize that feeling. And, you know, I feel like it comes naturally if you're there. But there are also times where we are in nature, and I don't know if you ever feel this way, but you're going on a walk or you're thinking, okay, this is my time where I'm going to take a moment for myself.
Totally.
And instead, all you do is make lists of things to do. Or who
yes,
you need
also,
to call.
Totally.
Yes. Or think about, you know, the state of the world or, you know, the ways in which you have failed. And my hope is that you read this poem and you remember where you are, that you stop for a moment and remember where you are on this spinning earth that we must protect.
I want to ask about creating poetry in this moment. We're living in a moment where President Trump has taken on some of the great cultural pillars of our country. He has installed himself as chairman of the Kennedy Center. He has issued executive orders to force changes at the Smithsonian. How are you thinking about creating art, creating something of beauty in this moment?
You know, I was just speaking to a former poet laureate, and I was thinking about how in the role, a lot of what you do is talk about poetry and the importance of poetry. And then there's a moment where you think, you know, you're in your kitchen, you're listening to the news, and you think, does it matter? Does it really matter?
Yeah, like is this so beside the point?
To write a poem, right?
Yeah.
When what we need is so huge, monumental, the collective action that is required. And then you think, there is such a proliferation of meanness. And what we're seeing right now is power and domination and meanness rewarded. And then you think, what if poetry can bring you back to wonder, to kindness, to care, to sensitivity, to tenderness? And even in that small moment, isn't that a radical act?
Ada Limón. She's just wrapped up her tenure as 24th Poet Laureate of the United States. Ada Limón, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump finished 100 days in office. What does Steve Bannon see for the next 100?
There's going to be a confrontation. I think the convergence, particularly of spending cuts and the simultaneously constitutional crisis that we're hurtling to, is going to make this summer a summer like no other.
A longtime Trump ally on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump is marking his first 100 days in office.
A new NPR PBS News Marist National poll finds a majority of Americans disapprove of the job he's doing.
I think he's doing too much too fast. It's going to definitely have a long-term effect on the economy.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has signed an executive order to bolster law enforcement. As NPR's Martin Costi tells us, it's a long list of initiatives meant to, quote, unleash high-impact local police forces.
The list of initiatives includes promises to improve police pay, training, and data collection. Peter Moskos is a former cop, professor, and author of Back from the Brink, about the NYPD's successes bringing down crime in the 1990s. And he likes the first part of the executive order.
I think, like a lot of so-called reform, there's a lot of good stuff in it, but in this case, those tasty morsels are combined with poison pills.
The order also calls for, quote, legal remedies when police impede federal law enforcement or employ DEI policies, something Moskos sees as federal overreach to try to control local law enforcement. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Americans are feeling pessimistic about the country's economic outlook. NPR's Scott Horsley tells us consumer confidence has fallen to its lowest level since the start of the pandemic.
The Consumer Confidence Index, compiled by the Nonprofit Conference Board, has been falling for five straight months. Even though many people feel okay about their current financial situation, their expectations for the future have turned decidedly gloomy. Tariffs have become a top concern, with many consumers saying they're worried import taxes will drive up prices and possibly drag the economy into recession. Expectations for the job market are the worst since 2009, when the economy was hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of jobs every month. Volatility in the stock market has also taken a toll on confidence, but some people surveyed say they're encouraged by the recent drop in the price of gasoline. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli and Hamas officials held talks in Cairo to discuss a ceasefire in Gaza, but neither side indicated a breakthrough in negotiations. Israel has rejected Hamas's offer for a five-year truce. This is NPR. In Paris, the trial of 12 people accused of robbing reality TV star Kim Kardashian during Paris Fashion Week 9 years ago just opened. Kardashian isn't expected to testify until mid-May. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
L'une des plus grandes stars américaines.
It's being described as the clash of two worlds, that of a modern Instagram influencer and 1980s-era bungling thieves. The grandpa robbers, as they've been dubbed, arrived at Kardashian's luxury hotel in October 2016 by bike and on foot. Some didn't even know who Kardashian was. I just knew she was a rapper's wife, said suspect Eunice Abbas in a TV interview. Abbas drove the getaway bike. He describes falling because of a flat tire as the jewels spilled all over the sidewalk. The thieves were caught within 4 months after leaving their DNA all over the hotel room. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Major U.S. companies facing a difficult task in estimating the impact of President Trump's tariffs on their business as they report their latest financial results this week. That's left some companies unable to issue economic forecasts with any real level of confidence. Others are making their best estimates based on what they know at the moment, and some are just pulling their financial outlooks altogether. This is NPR News. NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump took office with a big list of campaign promises to fulfill, vowing to crack down on illegal immigration and grow the U.S. economy. But 100 days later, a majority of Americans say that they disapprove of the job he is doing as president. That's according to the latest NPR PBS News Marist National poll that's out today. And NPR's Elena Moore is here to tell us all about it. Hi.
Hey.
So, Elena, tell us, how are voters feeling about President Trump?
Well, overall, Trump's approval rating is now down to 42%. And when asked to grade him on his first 100 days, a plurality of Americans, 45%, gave him a failing grade. Democrats are really driving that. 8 in 10 feel that way, while just 5% of Republicans do. Instead, a majority gave the president an A. But Trump's standing with independents is notable. You know, he made gains with this group last fall, but in this poll, nearly half give him an F. Michigan independent voter Michael Corwin wouldn't go that far with me. 4 years ago, he voted for Joe Biden, but this fall, he flipped for Trump and says he puts the president in the B range. He does have some reservations, particularly around Trump's handling of the economy. So he says he isn't surprised that he got low marks from other independents.
I don't know if they knew what they were getting into, a lot of them. I think he's doing too much too fast. It's going to definitely have a long-term effect on the economy.
Elena Moore, stay with us on that for a second. President Trump ran on lowering prices. Do voters think that he's kept his promise there?
Yeah, the economy was one of Trump's strongest issues during the election, but now 55% of adults say that they disapprove of his handling of the economy. Importantly, that includes 6 in 10 independents and 17% of Republicans. It's actually Corwin in Michigan's biggest holdup. Part of the reason he supported Trump was because of the economy, so he says he's disappointed.
I don't think he's paid as much attention to it as he should have. It feels like it's the same, basically, as when it was Biden. I mean, everything's still kind of expensive.
How much of the current disapproval might have to do with President Trump's tariff policy?
I think it's pretty connected. I mean, many Americans are still regrouping after those big drops in the markets at the beginning of this month when Trump unveiled steep tariffs on countries around the world. He's walked many of those tariffs back, but that rollout didn't get good marks. I mean, nearly 6 in 10 Americans said that placing tariffs on imports hurts the U.S. economy.
Okay, and then there is immigration, which has, of course, been a central issue in President Trump's second term. What can you tell us about how voters are feeling about his immigration policy?
A majority of independents disapprove, as do most Democrats, but for Republicans, reducing illegal immigration was the cornerstone of Trump's campaign. In fact, 87% think he's keeping that promise. And that holds true even on more divisive instances. You know, more than 7 in 10 Republicans approve of the administration's handling of the Kilmer Abrego Garcia case. And despite court orders, you know, the administration has refused to bring him back after illegally deporting him to El Salvador.
Which brings us to another key part of Trump's first 100 days, which is his relationship with the courts. Where do voters stand there?
There is very little disagreement here. You know, 85% of Americans agree that Trump should obey federal court rulings. That includes nearly 8 in 10 Republicans, you know, like Abby Smith in Texas, who is an attorney. But she does admit this is complicated for her.
I have sympathy for both sides because on the one hand, you always want to follow the court's order. But on the other hand, I do think that many of the court orders have been unjustified and unreasonable.
And Trump has said he would never defy the Supreme Court. But in the Abrego Garcia case, the justices did rule that the administration should facilitate his return. And one of that has not happened.
NPR's Elena Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
And and now to Wall Street. Since President Trump took office, the S&P 500 has plummeted by more than 7%. That is the worst performance in a president's first 100 days since the early 1970s. For many Americans, that has meant anxiety about their retirement accounts. And as NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports, some people are reassessing when they will be able to stop working.
For Laura Anderson, the last few weeks have brought uneasiness.
It's like anything can happen, which makes it difficult to plan.
She's 61 and teaches at a university in Cincinnati and had been planning to retire in 5 or 6 years. But with the markets lately, that milestone could be further off.
I think now it's going to be longer than that by a few years. Everything's being impacted right now with the tariff situation and other economic issues.
When she looked at her 401k recently, she was rattled. Though after talking with her financial advisor, she felt a bit better.
It felt like a significant loss to me, but as I talked to my financial advisor the other day, he said I was like 1.5% down. They've done very good for me in terms of trying to keep things so that when the market swings very bad, my stuff doesn't swing quite as badly.
But she's still feeling some worry. And with the stock market fluctuation and the cost of things going up,
I just feel like there's so much uncertainty right now that I still don't feel like my original retirement plan is going to be doable.
That uncertainty is shared by many who are reaching retirement age. More than 4 million Americans turn 65 this year, and the next, and the next. And market whiplash can give even the most cautious investor cause for concern. Amy Rowland is one of them. She's 63 and runs a small nonprofit in Salt Lake City. She was feeling confident she was on the right track for retirement until she recently checked her account.
And then it is a fairly big reduction to the dollars. And it's just scary seeing the reduction amount be, you know, more than what I make in a year, more than what I make in, I think, 2 years is what it looked like.
She's still making her typical contributions, especially since there's an employer match. But all the turmoil has given her reason to reconsider.
As things don't get better, you feel like, am I throwing money in just to see it shrink? You know, that seems like a bad idea too.
Of course, the markets may rebound, but the volatility can shake people's confidence. For Roland and her husband, the timing of this tariff drama isn't great. At the end of December, they bought a small fixer-upper to renovate, with a plan to sell their current home and downsize to the smaller house. They were excited and planned to use some of their money to outfit the new house, with a new refrigerator and a second bathroom.
Should I be spending that money now? And how much more is all this going to cost now? And suddenly that whole plan definitely feels like at this moment, this is maybe the dumbest moment to do it.
She knows other folks have it a lot worse, but she was trying to do what felt like the right thing, to start clearing the path for younger folks.
Part of the other reason for retiring is this feeling that it is time for the younger generation to get the jobs, you know. And so part of me retiring is kind of that feeling of, yeah, it is probably time for my generation to step aside, but we can't do it if we don't think we can survive our retirement years.
It's that feeling that may cause those who can to keep working. In a moment when the future is hard to predict, many are holding on to what they've got. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Over 4 days in April, a group of women from all over the world, from Kenya to France to the United States, traveled to South Africa to prove just how tough older women can be. The event, the Grannies International Football Tournament, that is soccer to us. Reporter Ryan Lenora Brown sends us the story.
It's a hot, sticky April morning in Nkoankoa, South Africa. A parade of soccer teams streams into the local stadium. One of them sings a fight song. The words translate to something like, "We're going to play ball. The grannies are going to play soccer." Think of this as a World Cup of sorts, one exclusively for women over 50. Teams from 7 countries have come to this South African farming town to compete. 2 squads from Boston hand out tiny American flags to the crowd.
We're a long, long way to South Africa.
Many of these teams are fielding players in their 70s or even 80s. And the soccer is good, like really good. Lillian Zulu is a 54-year-old grandmother from Zambia.
You know, I've got my talent in football. It's the way I run. I'm very quick. I play like Messi, you know. It's a joke.
It's not really, though. Zulu is the captain of Team Zambia, and she is lightning quick. This is the second edition of the Grannies International Football Tournament. But many players are here for the first time. And this is a kind of adoration they never dreamed of. Here's French player Anne Ozebi, who is 52.
It was like when a dream come true, you know? Like if you were professional football players.
I also meet Fikile Sitole, age 55, who has actually known some soccer fame. In the 1990s, she was part of post-apartheid South Africa's first women's national team. And now, she's back on the pitch.
We train, we try and push ourselves, let's do something, let's not just sit. And it's gonna take us long to get old.
These days, she's playing for a Grannies team from the city of Mbombela. She and her teammates glide across the field, using a well-known South African style called shoeshine and piano, with dance-like footwork and tight passes. They storm all the way to the semifinals and lead that game until the final 5 minutes. But then, their French opponents come roaring back. It's a crushing defeat. But as soon as the game is over, players from the opposing sides pull each other into sweaty hugs. It's like that at this tournament. On the field, no one holds back. And in the stands, it's basically a non-stop party led by the South Africans. In the end, an American team wins the tournament. But there's also an award you wouldn't expect at a soccer tournament. In a black tracksuit wrapped in a Kenyan flag, Tala Kaino takes the stage. She is 87 years old. A fitting way to end a tournament that doesn't see aging as something to run from. Here, in fact, it's a badge of honor. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Lenora Brown.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Older Americans say they want to know if they are in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and they would happily take a blood test to find out. That's according to a new national survey by the Alzheimer's Association. NPR's John Hamilton reports the results show how attitudes toward the disease are changing.
Historically, people experiencing problems with memory and thinking have been hesitant to learn the cause. Elizabeth Edgerly is a clinical psychologist who directs community programs for the Alzheimer's Association.
People would often say, well, gosh, I wouldn't want to know, or why would I want to know?
But Edgerly says the association survey of 1,700 Americans 45 and older shows that's no longer the case.
79% said that they would like to know if they had Alzheimer's before the symptoms appear, or at least before the symptoms affect their daily activities.
One reason may be that it's now easier to find out. Just a few years ago, it took a PET scan or spinal tap to confirm the presence of sticky amyloid plaques in the brain. Now a simple blood test can provide the answer. Edgerly says survey respondents were enthusiastic about this approach.
9 out of 10 people said, yeah, I would take a blood test, and especially if I know that if I have Alzheimer's, there's something I can do about it.
Like drug treatment. Most respondents said they would take a medication to slow down the disease, even if it had risks. There are now 2 drugs like that on the market. And Edgerly says that gives people another reason to get a diagnosis while they are still capable of making their own decisions.
Now people can speak for themselves. They can articulate what they'd like for their future. They can decide whether they want to try treatments. It's really a very different situation.
Alzheimer's remains a formidable disease, but Dr. Nathaniel Chin, a geriatrician at the University of Wisconsin, says people living with Alzheimer's disease are more optimistic now that drug treatment is possible.
Even if it doesn't stop the disease in its tracks, I think it tells people that we're making progress and they want to know if they potentially could have this therapy or maybe the next therapy or 2 therapies down the road.
Chin says the survey results are in line with what he's seeing in his own practice.
I don't think people are as fearful as they have been in the past. I think there's a desire to just know what's happening to our bodies.
Chin says many doctors, though, are still skeptical about drug treatment, which offers only a modest benefit. As a result, he says, many are still reluctant to urge their patients to get tested.
Some patients are ahead of their doctors in this regard. They are thinking about this, they want this information, and they're going to ask about it.
Chin says he does offer blood tests to patients with cognitive problems, and he expects the test to become increasingly common. But that's likely to bring some new challenges. For example, many health professionals are not trained to counsel people who have just learned they have Alzheimer's. And Chin says a positive test result in someone's medical record has the potential to jeopardize their job or health insurance.
There are protections for people who learn their genetic information, but as of now, there are not protections for people who are learning if you are cognitively unimpaired or cognitively healthy.
Chin says now that more people are finding out, it's up to groups including the Alzheimer's Association to push for those protections. John Hamilton, NPR News.
In 2004, a former pro baseball player started writing a self-help book. In 2009, it was published. Some 15 years later, it wasn't exactly making waves. There were more than 500,000 other books trending ahead of it on Amazon. But then this past January, millions of NFL fans saw Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver A.J. Brown flipping through that book during a crucial game. The Eagles won that night, and they went on to win the Super Bowl. And overnight, the book jumped to the top of the charts. It's called Inner Excellence, and it's now been republished in a major book deal. Author Jim Murphy joins me now. Hi there.
Thanks so much for having me.
I remember seeing the images of A.J. Brown reading that book everywhere on my social media. I just wonder if you can start by describing for us the night of and immediately after the wild card win for the Eagles. I mean, your phone must have been blowing up.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. It was actually a very surreal few days for me. January 12th, that day, I was walking around downtown Dallas, and it was kind of a somber time in my life. Business was kind of slow. I actually didn't pay off my credit cards in January, and my mom was dying. Mm. And a few hours before the game, I'm walking around the empty city, and I look up the skyscraper, and I see this huge building, and the thought comes to mind, would you rather own that building or rather have written this book, The Best Possible Life and Inner Excellence, like learn what you've learned? And then 3 hours later, my life changed greatly. I was sitting in my hotel room, and then I looked at my phone and I see all these messages, and my mom died 4 days later. And so I thought it was messages saying my mom had died. And, but instead they're like, you need to check out this Eagles Packers game.
Well, first of all, I just want to say, I'm so sorry about the loss of your mom.
Thank you.
I mean, it sounds really surreal. The fact that this is a book you started writing in 2004 and it's hitting peak popularity now in 2025. Can you talk about that a bit?
People would ask me, how's the book doing? And I'd say, you know what? It's good, because I wrote it to get clients, and my career had been going great. But I think sales were slow, so eventually I got the rights to it and self-published. But in between, I went to the desert to live a life of solitude. Mm. And I spent my life savings, was $90,000 in debt. And that actually created a lot of anxiety, and because, you know, we're created for relationship. And when you isolate yourself for any period of time, there's no one there to doubt your doubts and to remind you who you are and what's possible. And so I had this near mental breakdown, and then my life dramatically changed.
Is there anything new or different about this new edition of the book from the original versions?
The concepts are very similar. What I've realized is that what I've always really wanted was to feel fully alive. Coaching pro athletes for the last decade or two, you know, they're the same as us. They have the same limiting beliefs and negative thoughts and this concern for self. What are people going to think of me if I fail? And inner excellence is really about focusing on the process of developing yourself, developing inner peace and inner strength, and learning to train your heart to love most what's most empowering, and not get make what you love most something that's temporary and superficial, like some result.
Just thinking about the way that you described, you know, needing to not get wrapped up and enveloped in stressing about the things we can't control. I mean, I think some people might find it challenging to find a silver lining right now. What would you say to a person who feels like they can't let it go?
Yeah, we really need to redefine success on things that you can control. Give the best of what you have every day, and realizing that some days you're not going to have much to give. We're going to give 100% of whatever you have, and some days it's only going to be 20-30%.
You've said that writing this book and its overnight popularity, that was never really the point or the goal for you. So, Jim Murphy, what is it all about for you?
Yeah, I want to live my purpose. The American dream is to be, you know, rich and famous and successful. So I realize that's what people think is amazing. But what's amazing is the impact you have on other people. And when you start thinking that you're the one that did something great, that's what leads to fear and anxiety, when you start to make your life about you. And when you can be selfless, then you can be fearless. And that's what I want the world to know.
That's incredible. Jim Murphy, author of the viral book Inner Excellence, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research.
Of a term that is fine and modern. So when you hear me mention potato, I mean a pretty girl with